One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello, my friend, and welcome to Catch Up with Louise McSharry. I am Louise McSharry, and the point of this podcast is to try and bring you up to date. If you haven't been paying attention, if you've been really busy, maybe you have kids who are taking up all of your spare time and a job which is not giving you a moment to even take a breath, and you just haven't been able to engage with the world this week, no problem. Maybe you've been feeling really bleak and you just haven't wanted to. That is also no problem. We are here to hopefully make you feel a little bit more up to date ahead of and across the weekend. I hope you're feeling well. Hope you had a good week. If not, no worries. January can be tough. I have to say I was feeling pretty bleak the first couple of weeks, but it's only been a couple of weeks. It just feels like it's been much longer. But the beginning of January, I think, was kind of tricky. But now I'm feeling a little bit more positive. I mean, things are still difficult. I was at the protest in Dublin for the International Day of Action regarding what's happening in Gaza. And it's a real kind of mishmash of feelings, isn't it? I think if you're someone who's been thinking about this situation since the very beginning, it would be weird if you didn't feel kind of heartbroken and exhausted at this point, because unfortunately not much progress has been made in terms of stopping the killing of Palestinians and the bombing of Gaza and the attacks on Gaza. In terms of progress for the Israelis getting back the hostages who were taken on October 7th, the only time that progress has been made there is when there was an agreed and brief ceasefire or kind of lowering of the conflict. You would think that therefore, you know, a longer ceasefire might actually get them to their apparent goal of getting their hostages returned, but that doesn't seem to be something that they're willing to consider. And yeah, you would feel it is hard not to feel depressed. Let's be honest. Very hard to be confronted with the reality of what's happening there all the while you're living your kind of normal life. It's a lot to process and it's very difficult, but I did find it really heartening to be out on the streets with thousands and thousands of like-minded people in Dublin on Saturday. And I know that there were events right around the world, so you may well have been at one in your own area or country. And I found some of the posters that people made. There was a beautiful work of art by Elaine Mears, which I posted to my Instagram. It was a depiction of the woman holding the wrapped body of her child, which is an image that I think is burned into loads and loads of our brains. And it just was so moving. She made a really beautiful piece of that image. And it was kind of confronting to see something so beautiful made out of something so heartbreaking. I found it very, very moving. I was talking to her about it on Instagram, and she said that she had made it from Irish linen in a nod to the shared textile heritages of Israel and Palestine, which I thought was another beautiful detail. So it's just great to see so many people still willing to get out on the street and say that this isn't good enough. It is, of course, devastating that that doesn't seem to be having the impact that we wish it did, but what else can we do really at this point? And we have to just continue to get out and get our voices to be heard. So it is a hard time to be a human being on the planet if you are someone who is empathetic and connected to what's going on around the world. But, you know, I think that we are doing our best and we have to continue to do our best in that regard. Otherwise, this week, I didn't do a lot. I went to see Poor Things, I went to see most of Poor Things. About 2 hours into Poor Things, I got a message to say that my son's football was at 5 instead of 6, so I had to miss the end, so I'll have to go again. But what I saw, I loved. Oh my God, I loved it. And I'm kind of in a bit of a cinema buzz at the moment. I haven't been out, you know, in a pub or anything since the end of December. So I'm basically a nun now, which is cool. I feel pure now. I haven't been drinking wine at home, of course, but you know, I haven't been out in the world in a way that hasn't been kind of entirely wholesome in a few weeks. Now, am I going to destroy that this weekend? Yes, of course I am. I've got 2 birthday parties to attend, but I've been enjoying this little cinema era, and I'm going to try and do more cinema trips over the course of the next year. I think it's just sometimes it's hard to prioritize that when you're busy with the kids and work and all the rest. But yeah, so largely a good week. And as I say, I hope you had one too, but it's okay if you're struggling because things are hard and it is so cold, which is just not helping. And I believe you will hear me complaining about the cold weather across this podcast, which I apologize for from the outset. Anyway, let's get going. It is time to catch up on all the latest in the news with Carl Kinsella. Carl Kinsella of thejournal.ie. Hello, how are you? How is your life?
Oh, it's going pretty well. It's nice to be back in Amsterdam after a Christmas break at home and freezing cold, but like, yeah, everything's all good.
I got some very funny messages from people who were very amused by you. I think it was last week when I was saying that like the kids weren't back for a week. You know, we were back at work and then the kids were back to a week later. People were like, how adorable, that Carl just genuinely did not know if that was a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, and honestly, like my instinct was like I don't know, but I think when it it's funny as well because like I still convince myself that I'm like young enough that I'd like that's all sort of it should be like a mystery to me, when obviously like I'm 30 years old, plenty of my friends have children.
No,
like,
you're very young.
This is something that I should have.
No,
I
you're not
have a grasp on all of this.
You're not in that space yet, and you're lucky to not be in that space yet. Enjoy it while you can. And we all found it very endearing, Carl, so do not worry.
I'm glad people are like amused by my naivete.
Well, they were. They really were. And yeah. I was. Okay, we've got loads of news to talk about this week, as usual. And we will start in Gaza, where unfortunately the situation is ongoing. I actually, like, I'm going to be honest. When I was making the list of stories this week, it has gotten to the point where you struggle to feel like it's useful even to talk about it. But you also know that you have to keep talking about it. We can't look away. We can't pretend like it's not happening. But at this point, it feels like nothing is going to change the situation.
Yeah, and it's actually interesting you should mention that, because that sort of citizen journalist, Bisan Auda, who like a lot of people will have followed over the last couple of months, she kind of did a broadcast from a hospital in Khan Yunis this week that was being bombed. And she herself, she like directly was like, oh, it's important to me that you keep sharing this, you know, referring to us in the sort of Western world.
Yeah.
And I think for as long as that remains the demand from, you know, journalists and activists on the ground in Palestine, or just even ordinary Palestinians, I think, yeah, it just remains essential that people keep talking about it, even though I fully agree with you. Like, it feels so futile. You know, some of the stories we were looking at this week, you know, the Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, has said that they're going to enter a de-intensification period, which essentially just means that they're going to be killing slightly fewer people.
But also, presumably because they're done. Like, there's only so much country to bomb. Like, of course, things will de-intensify because you have pulverized these people and this nation.
And it also kind of gives the lie to the entire sort of campaign, because for so long they've talked about how, oh, this would all end tomorrow if the remaining hostages were returned. But here they are, you know, quote unquote, de-intensifying, even though they've made no or very little progress with the hostages.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it does suggest that the purpose behind all of this has been sort of, as you say, to flatten Gaza, to ethnically cleanse, to remove Palestinians from the area, and then for, you know, the state of Israel to sort of take over. And, you know, even with all this de-intensification talk, you know, Netanyahu was clear this week. He's speaking in the Knesset, in the Israeli parliament, and he was saying that the fighting is going to continue for months. They've just approved a new budget of, I think, something like $13 billion worth of military funding to keep up with the cost of the campaign. So, you know, I think, you know, this talk of de-intensification, for me, that could be something to do with traditional media in the West wanting for something reasonable to latch onto, you know, and they want to report that there's a de-intensification. So they're latching onto that language from the Israeli, you know, political establishment. But the fact is that, you know, for someone like you or me watching through our phones, it's not going to look like de-intensification. It's just going to look like the same old rubble and bloodshed and, you know, dead children. And, you know, from the outside looking in, it's just the atrocity will continue, I think, almost certainly.
Yeah. There was a deal, I kind of couldn't make sense of this, a deal made during the week, which between Israel and Hamas, which is about basically medical aid getting in for hostages in order, and that meaning that therefore civilians will also receive aid. We're all clutching at straws for any kind of positive news, I suppose.
Yeah, and for me, like, you know, unfortunately, this kind of, it's not really a positive story. It, you know, it means that the hostages who are taken on October 7th, they'll get sort of medicines that they might need, you know, say, for example, if they could be diabetic, they could be anything like that. So in order for that medicine to get in, they've struck a deal whereby aid will get to civilians in Gaza. But for me, all this does is highlight that Israel is acknowledging that it's been preventing aid from getting to civilians in Gaza. You know, like, you have Israel very much making the claim that Hamas takes all this aid, you know, this food aid that comes in, the water that comes in, that Hamas takes it. And, you know, that's why Palestinians aren't able to get to it. But if Israel are able to strike a deal whereby they can assure that the aid gets to these civilians, then we know that Israel has the power to do that any given day. And the fact that they're not doing it is, I mean, that is, you know, if things were to progress any further at the ICJ and The Hague, you know, that is a war crime to deny people sort of, to starve people and to deny them water. That is, you know, it's pretty much as bad as it gets. As you say, this is a deal being struck, you know, this is kind of through the Hamas political leadership are based in Qatar. So Qatar facilitates all of these sort of deals. And I don't know, maybe there's a perspective on it where it's like there's more communication happening and maybe this could lead to an opportunity for more like detente, but I don't know, it doesn't feel positive to me.
What is happening with the ICJ and in The Hague? Like, what's where do things stand at the moment with the South African case against Israel?
So the latest development is that we've got Indonesia and Slovenia have joined the South Africa's application at the ICJ. And I suppose the intent is that what they want is that they want a verdict of genocidal intent to be rendered against Israel. And like, so that's different to like actually having committed the genocide. You know, they just want an acknowledgement that there's intent to commit genocide, which, you know, that's why they relied so heavily on statements by Israeli cabinet ministers and things like that last week. But so that'll be deliberated upon. And if it is found that there has been genocidal intent, that's where the sort of complications kick off, because there's not a very strong enforcement mechanism. You know, you can't haul Israeli leaders from Jerusalem and Tel Aviv in front of The Hague. You can't, you know, it's a very complicated process, but it would at least be a sort of not necessarily a moral victory. I suppose moral victory might be the phrase, but just it's something to galvanize the international community, but so that's where we are with the ICJ.
Lots of continued blame at the feet of Joe Biden, who obviously America is funding a lot of the weapons that Israel are able to use in for this continued onslaught. And there are calls for the traditional Irish St. Patrick's Day visits to be called off this year.
Yeah, and that's kind of been buzzing around for the last couple of months. I know Paul Murphy, he kind of restated this this sort of demand of the Irish Taoiseach, because obviously, like, year on year, the Irish Taoiseach will visit Washington, D.C. and hand over the bowl of shamrocks. And it's all a bit of a, you know, a bit of a boondoggle for Irish TDs and Irish media. And it is probably good for diplomacy. But yeah, one would think that at a time of such controversy and consternation and you know, with the Irish government acknowledging, you would hope on some level, that the US is behind, is providing military, you know, foundations for all this death and destruction in Gaza, you would think that there would be some change in the relationship between the Irish government and the US government, that there would be some demands made or some sort of, you know, overtures made in terms of scaling back the level of support for Israel's campaign. But yeah, I think it's very unlikely that Leo Varadkar is not going to visit.
No, of course he is.
Washington, yeah, there's like, you know, it's even Mary Lou McDonald has said that if she were to become Taoiseach, you know, say by 2025, that she doesn't think that boycotting such an event would lead to you know, peace in the Middle East, which I just think is, it's sort of like a reductive way of looking at it. Nobody is saying, Paul Murphy's not saying that it's going to lead to peace in the Middle East. It's a symbolic gesture of sort of condemnation and pointing out something that, you know, the people of Ireland really don't agree with.
Yeah. Claire Daly made a very impassioned speech in the European Parliament during the week, which I will try and put a clip in here. I keep forgetting to put in clips. I keep saying I'm going to put in a clip and then forgetting to do it. So I'm writing it down literally as I say this.
Despite the catastrophic death toll it has inflicted, Israel is losing on the ground and in the court of public opinion. There's no way that this ends that doesn't leave Israel a pariah state with occupation and apartheid on borrowed time, and they know it. So they're doing everything they can. Desperate acts of aggression to provoke a wider conflict with Lebanon, with Iran, with anybody, to draw in the US, to save them from the consequences of their own actions. And as Yemen shows, Butcher Biden is reporting for duty. With Europe's Frau Genocide by his side, they are the ones who have enabled the continuation of Israeli terror. Without them, it would already be over. So take note, Butcher Biden. The ancestors of the Ireland that you claim to be from disown you. Keep our country out of your mouth. And as for von der Leyen and genocidal Germany, with your words and deeds supporting Israel in the ICJ, not in our name. The people of Europe stand with Palestine and with South Africa.
And I, you know, there are a lot of people who would agree with her.
Yeah, well, we've seen, you know, there was in his sort of ancestral home of Ballina in Mayo, there was a mural painted for him when he first visited. I think that's been defaced a couple of times since the conflict in Gaza has sort of escalated. And there was also, I think, quite a widely signed, widely shared petition about sort of revoking Ireland's symbolic support for his 2024 campaign. You know, obviously, that sort of, it doesn't really mean anything. You know, we don't, I mean, to even assume that we symbolically support his campaign, I think is kind of strange. But it does highlight the level of dissatisfaction, I think, among Irish people with, because I mean, typically, I think you and I both know this, you know, Irish people tend to be very excited about US presidents. We tend to be very excited when they pay attention to us.
I mean, hello, and Barack Obama Plaza. Like, yes.
100%. But yeah, I think if you were to poll the Irish people right now and Joe Biden, you'd definitely find a high level of negativity.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, speaking of negativity, let's move to Ross Cray, where there were, well, a lot happened this week, didn't it?
This has kind of been going on even for more than a week now, and it's hundreds at times of protesters outside Racket Hall Hotel in Ross Cray, where international protection applicants are being housed. That was announced kind of in the last week or two. And, you know, a lot of people from Ross Cray mobilized and they're protesting against it. There's also been people sort of, not necessarily astroturfed in, but, you know, people who are sort of far right demonstrators who tend to turn up at a lot of these things across the country. They're also there sort of galvanizing the crowd and speaking to the crowd. Matty McGrath, the TD, was there. He was there and he spoke about Ireland being quote unquote colonized and Ireland being taken over, you know, presumably referring to international applicants or people from Ukraine. And, you know, it's a really kind of unpleasant sight, because what you've got is all these people, you know, chanting and protesting and demonstrating and being loud and being aggressive, getting into scuffles with Gardaí as women and children arrive, you know, just to be housed in this former hotel. So like these people arriving, the women and children, they're already in such a lowly state, you know,
vulnerable,
and
like position, for them to be
yeah, and it's kind of a worrying situation for me, because it reminds me somewhat of like back in 2010 2011 when a lot of people who had problems with the state sort of coalesced around the water charges. And I'm worried that this is kind of like a far right version of that almost, where you have people in towns that have been underserved, people in towns where, you know, the hotels have closed down, the pubs have closed down, there's nothing to do, there's no services. And instead of those people blaming the government or engaging with the government, they are protesting outside, you know, places where international applicants, as we said, women and children are arriving to stay for sort of safety and shelter. Mm. So it's a very kind of worrying state of affairs. And I think what we're seeing in Ross Cray is we're getting more of the government sort of kowtowing to this movement. You know, like there's been talk of providing this sort of community hotel for the people of Ross Cray, which is an interesting idea because like it injects some life into the town. And there's been successful examples of that in other towns. But it is just strange because it does suggest that the fact that these people are going and protesting in this way where they're, you know, outside a building with women and children in it, that is kind of, it's starting to get results in terms of the government paying attention to them, which is kind of, that's pretty concerning.
It is concerning. And like, you know, look, like, as you say, often this kind of thing is the result of genuine concerns and genuine worries about your community or your town or genuine fear. That's what feeds into this kind of thing happening, these kind of protests. The far right definitely take advantage of people who have genuine concerns. But, you know, if that starts to work for people, then obviously they're going to continue to do it. And the connection between the two things is kind of strengthened, even though there isn't really a connection. So it is, you're right, it is worrying. And, you know, I just found the footage of, you know, people being shouted at, children being shouted at as they were trying to make their way into a temporary new home, coming from God knows what circumstances, really difficult to watch. And I know a lot of people did as well. But, you know, the government really need to look at this. This is something that they need to tackle. And in fairness, I did see a discussion during the week which did acknowledge that, you know, the communication is poor and that they really need to improve things if they want this kind of protesting to stop. But I worry it's too late.
Yeah, well, for me, I think there's a more cynical way you can look at it, which is that, you know, if there are two groups that can be blamed between sort of an out group in terms of, you know, international protection applicants or the government who have failed to sort of provide certain services in local areas for 10 years, that the government would be happier. And this is, you know, this is not me saying what's happening, it's just a way of looking at it, that the government are happier for them not to get the blame. And so they're happier for the international protections to the applicants to soak up the blame. And I think that is a thing for people to bear in mind when they watch how the government responds to things like this, because, you know, we can talk about the communication not being there. We can talk about, you know, people like Roderick O'Gorman get criticized but like ultimately we are in a situation where the people who are protesting, there is definitely a level of like moral agency on their shoulders. Like, you know, even though things can be difficult in Ross Cray or things can be difficult in this town or that town, you know, there needs to be, as people have pointed out, if you want actual change, you know, your protest should be outside whatever Leinster House. They should be directed at the people who have the power to change the way that Ireland operates. And as far as, you know, because we talk about this whole thing, you know, Ireland is full, but Ireland isn't full. Ireland is, you know, hugely derelict. Ireland is empty in so many ways. And I think, you know, the responsibility for that does not lie with people coming from Ukraine or coming from Afghanistan. Yeah. It very much lies with the government. So it's just one of those things that you really hope that people start to see sense. And for me, that's where I think the communication comes in. For me, the communication, it shouldn't be about, you know, people talk about communication in terms of communities being alerted that international protection applicants are coming in. But for me, the key around communication is communicating to people that the issue isn't international protection applicants.
Yeah, absolutely.
It goes so much deeper. And that's where I would like to see kind of better communication.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I totally agree. And, you know, I think that's what, I wish I could remember who was saying it, but that's what this person was saying, was that, like, you know, if you look at even just the contribution to the economy that people from other countries make, you know, and that then is plowed back into, things like, you know, child benefit and, you know, people's pensions. And, you know, there is a contribution being made by people from other countries that people seem to forget about sometimes. Okay, let's move on to the Iowa caucus, which is a phrase I feel like lots of people will know about, but many people will be like, what does it actually mean?
Yeah, that's so funny you should say that, because that is exactly how I feel about the Iowa caucus as well. Like, I actually think that that's how, I honestly think that a lot of Americans, that's how they regard it as well, because obviously the Iowa caucus, it's the first of the primaries, mm-hmm. but it doesn't refer to itself as a primary. It refers to itself as a caucus.
And for people who don't know, like, what even is a primary?
So the primaries are how, you know, this is how the Democratic and Republican nominees for president get selected, is by the primaries. And that's each state has its own primary, or in some cases, a caucus to decide on their preferred nominee. So in this case, yeah, Donald Trump won with around 51% of the vote. Because the caucus system is kind of weird. You go to your local precinct or whatever, and then you kind of get organized into groups, and the groups can kind of speak on who they want to be the nominee, and they try to convince other people to come and join their group, and it's a big ritual, and it's strange. So Donald Trump, he won considerably ahead of Ron DeSantis. I think he beat DeSantis. DeSantis got about 21% of the vote. He's the governor of Florida. And Nikki Haley, former governor of South Carolina, she got about 19%. She was hoping to sort of come in second and to be a proper challenger for Trump. The next primary is New Hampshire, and Nikki Haley is polling quite well there. So she was kind of hoping to get a bit of momentum going into that. But it looks like it's Trump's to win, to be honest. Like, he would have hoped for better than, I think, 51%. But I mean, given that he's up against several other candidates, 51% is pretty strong.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it is worrying if you look at things like, for example, as discussed, what's happening in Palestine and the American role in that. Like, that's not going to do Joe Biden any favors with a lot of young progressive voters. So I saw Bernie Sanders tweeting during the week that basically the Democratic Party has to provide like a genuinely progressive alternative to a Donald Trump, so that, because it can't just be we're voting for the Democrats because we don't want to vote for Donald Trump. Like, they need more than that.
Absolutely. And, you know, you even see it with the reputation of Bernie Sanders. His reputation has suffered in the last couple of months because he has been quite slow to react to the situation in Gaza and Israel. This week he called for an investigation into whether or not Israel is sort of committing war crimes, and for aid packages to be tied to the results of that investigation. But that was shot down. But he's really the only, and again, we can't state enough, he's kind of doing the bare minimum, and even he is kind of the only one even doing the bare minimum.
Yeah.
And that goes to your point about, yeah, the Democratic Party right now, they're not, you know, there's certain things that American politicos will kind of point towards, things like the economy is not so bad. And, you know, certain things, like, there have been certain small changes made, like getting rid of bank overdraft fees, things that appeal to people. But yeah, there's no denying that Joe Biden has lost critical support from young people, because young people in the U.S., are quite sympathetic to the plight of Palestinians.
Yeah, well, I saw someone on TikTok this week saying that, you know, one of their big problems is literally TikTok, because, you know, young Americans are on TikTok, and so therefore they have access to, you know, people on the ground in Palestine, people like Bassan, who you mentioned earlier, and they can see what's happening. And so, you know, you can't really, it's much harder to indoctrinate them or to kind of filter what's getting to them now than it was previously. And yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see what role that does play in politics. Very interesting indeed. But, you know, Jesus, you just hope it doesn't end up with a Donald Trump presidency again.
And right now, that's where my money would be.
I know, me too. And isn't that awful? Okay, we have two very quick ones to hit before we finish. And the first one is, I just thought that this was appalling, but not shocking, that during the week there was a committee hearing in which it was said that the children's mental health service is largely non-existent in Ireland.
Yeah, that was the phrase that was used. And this is the joint Oireachtas Committee on Health. They were talking about CAMHS, which is Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services in Ireland. And as you say, they were labelled by, it was a parents group that was in testifying, and they were talking about the sort of the biases faced by autistic children when they, you know, are seeking mental health services, and that, you know, apparently the situation now is that if you're autistic, you're far less likely to get at the services you need, because people are assuming that depression or this or that mental illness is just wrapped up in the diagnosis of autism, and that, you know, you should be left to the autism help services, you know, rather than getting specialized CAMHS treatment. But this is something that like has been going on, or something that we've been aware of now for years.
There are,
certain sections or certain parts of Ireland where if you are a child or you know, the parent of a child with a mental illness, that you cannot get help, and it's really very disturbing.
Well, what really gets to me is that, you know, you and I haven't had this conversation, but previously on the podcast we talked about TUSLA being in crisis, basically, and absolutely not having the resources that it needs to provide adequate care to this was a judge who said this, to provide adequate care to young people in Ireland who need to be cared for by TUSLA. So, you know, one of the symptoms and the side effects of that, of children not receiving adequate care, is, you know, problems with mental health. And so now we're looking at a situation where we are potentially giving young people problems with their mental health and then saying that we can't care for them when they have problems with their mental health. And that's, you know, just one section of the entire thing. And this is the thing that gets me when you see people who are saying that they want to protect the women and children of Ireland. I'm like, if you want to protect the children of Ireland, how about you turn your attention to the ways that the state is genuinely failing the children of Ireland? Like, put that energy into protesting about this stuff, and then you'll have a lot more people on your side, because this is a legitimate failure, and it is appalling.
It's failure is the perfect word for it, and it's something, whenever I read stories like this, it is exactly where my mind goes, because it's such a fundamental provision that the state is supposed to have in place for people. You know, it's such a, you know, in terms of the social contract, it's just an absolute cornerstone. If you're going to have trust in your state, if you're going to have trust in the people who run the state, then you need to know that children are able to access healthcare, whether that's, you know, physical healthcare or mental healthcare.
Yeah.
And the fact that as we're hearing, there is none of that available is just, it really is very frightening. You know, they were saying that about a third of the 16 teams required across the country have been established even. So like, that is just, it's a huge gap in public services.
It's a disgrace. Talk to Joe about it, but it is a disgrace. Yeah. And maybe we should be talking to Joe. I'm sure lots of people have. And then finally, I wanted to finish on a good news story. We've got some price cuts. Yes, yeah, bitch.
Yeah. At long last, getting some price cuts.
Honestly.
And like, this is so is Bord Gáis. They said they were cutting their residential electricity and gas by around 10%, and that's, you know, that's good news. It is crazy because, you know, we're seeing that even now with these reductions, it's still like, it's about twice what your bill would have been in like 2020, you know. So it's one of those funny things where you know, we're celebrating the prices going down, but it is like, it is actually just like a small decrease after a huge increase. But like, you know, let's just take what we can get.
We've just got to grab onto this.
You know, like, because
times are so hard. And Electric Ireland also cutting residential electricity prices. So, you know, thank God for small blessings. Is that an expression?
Yeah, you know, like, it'll amount to annual savings of about 100 euro, you know, for people. So like, it's not nothing, for sure.
It's not nothing, but it could be better.
Yeah. Maybe that can be like our motto for like the good news story each week. Just be like, well, it's not nothing, you know. Slightly better than nothing.
It's not nothing. Yeah. Wow. Put it on my tombstone. Well, Carl, thank you so much. You can read Carl's column, Surreeling in the Years, on thejournal.ie every week. It comes out every Saturday. And then you can also check out other bits of his writing there. Is there anywhere else you'd like to direct the people, Carl?
You can find me on Twitter at TV's Carl Kinsella and on Instagram at Carl.Kinsella.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Louise.
Garrod Farrelly is a comedian, a lovely man all round, I have to say. And if you went to see one of Joanne McNally's 150,000 shows for the Prosecco Express tour, you probably will have seen him opening up for her. He has his own tour at the moment, and I wanted to catch up with him, talk to him about the Joanne McNally effect and also what it was like to be a part of that tour, as well as his own career, where things are moving, and how it's changed direction in recent years. Garrod Farrelly, what a pleasure it is. Although it's so hard for me not to say Garrod because of Joanne McNally. That like Do you get that all the time?
All of the time. I swear to God, like, I've never felt more popular than, like, doing her tour. Like, I've had, like, the bizarrest experience just by association with her.
Yeah, well, let's, like, actually, I suppose let's start there. And we haven't even done any pleasantries, but let's just get straight into it. Because, you know, obviously Joanne is your great pal and your comedy colleague. And, you know, she had, the last couple of years for her have been, frankly, insane. And as her friend, it's been amazing to see, because she worked so hard for so long. But she's, you know, she just finished up the Prosecco Express. She just said she didn't even know how many of those gigs she did. But, like, it's got to be in the 100 kind of sphere.
Yeah, I mean, I think I did maybe 180 with her, I think.
180, because that's what I was going to say. You were there for most of them, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, on top of that, she did, like, you know, America and Canada and Dubai and Australia. And, you know, so, like, I honestly don't know how she's still standing, because I haven't done nowhere near as many shows as her. And I like, over Christmas, I was like, yeah, I need to be signed in now. I'm a dead body. I am in the throes of a mental and physical crisis.
So for anybody, I mean, the thing is, I think every woman in Ireland did go and see the Prosecco Express tour at some stage. And, you know, you were at the vast majority of those gigs. So people probably will have seen you opening for Joanne. But what was the experience like? I mean, you obviously had no idea at the start that it was, I presume, that it was going to end up being the phenomenon that it was.
Yeah, I mean, I my first experience of working with Joanne was her very first Vicar Street prior to COVID, I guess maybe a year before that, she asked me to open for her. And I thought, yeah, grand. I mean, I knew her. I didn't know her that well, but, like, we'd always get on when we gigged together. And then I guess through COVID we became friends, because we were both about to do tours and we were like, what's happening with the world? And I guess she became, during COVID, she became very ambitious, whereas I was exactly the opposite. I was like, oh, I'm done. Like, that's, I'm not going back to that. I feel like this is my easy out. This is, like, time, move on, do something else.
Yeah.
So she kind of, and she really pulled me back in, you know, to comedy. So when we started, I guess, her thoughts were, you know, this has blown up. We don't know how big it is. We don't know what it's going to be like. We don't know if, like, the people that bought tickets 6 months prior to lockdowns ending, we're still going to go, oh yeah, I want to go and see that girl.
Yeah.
So when we started the tour, we just didn't know what it was going to be like. I mean, I remember the first day, the first ones we did were Leicester Square, on the 3rd of December. Ireland was still in lockdown.
Right.
And we were, like, sitting backstage going, can we still do stand up? Like,
do we remember how? Like,
yeah. It's like, she used to do an hour, I used to do half an hour. It's like, can we? I don't know. I don't know if we still have the pain. And yeah, I remember us walking, like, out of that gig, and we were like, geez, they were up for it. Yeah. I wonder, like, what the tour is going to be like, because we weren't starting for another month.
Right.
And when we started in Baker Street, we were, we had to do two shows a day, because we were still, it was still at 50% capacity. We were still, there was a curfew for 8 o'clock.
God, it's mad to think about now, isn't it?
Yeah. It's insane. So, yeah, I mean, I guess, and then it just escalated into, like, within a couple of weeks, we knew how big it was going to be. And they were, like, was getting a tour on the books. Our UK agent was like, we need more dates. So our, like, there was basically, we were balancing three, an Irish tour, a UK tour, and my tour. We're just plugging in left, right, and center. So the year became crazy, because, like, gigs were just flung in wherever they could be put. So we had like nights we were in Cork, and the next night we were in Derry, and the night after that we were in Cork. Like, it was wild. And, like, we were in
and you were doing, like, all the driving, right?
I was doing the driving in a van.
Oh.
Like, yeah, it was bad. That was like, at some point I do remember, like, I remember being on the M50 in a van and Joanne just looking at me going, are you okay? And I was like, I'm not sure, but I feel somebody should just intervene and go, no, this is a really bad idea. But nobody did.
And look, you live to tell the tale, thank God.
Yeah.
And so what impact has it had for you, you know, on your career?
Yeah, I mean, it's been crazy. I mean, like, I've been going a long time, and I've, you know, I supported Neil Delamere for years. I was, you know, I was very much a comedy bridesmaid. And right. I guess around 2016, I kind of became, you know, I kind of thought, okay, this actually isn't going to happen. It will be, I'll be a club comic. There's a good living to be made just doing clubs and doing supports, but I'm not going to be a, I guess, your big selling headline act.
Right.
So I'd kind of resigned myself to that. But I guess what happened was I was always in front of the wrong audience.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, I was in front of a room full of women and gays. And I was like, oh my God. Like, I'll never forget it.
These are my people.
I was like, where have you been? Like, I remember in Galway, it was very early in Joanne's tour. Like, the Baker Street's have been going well, but I always think with a Baker Street, it's like, yeah, like, it was standing ovations and they love me. And but, like, yeah, of course, like, it's 1,000 people. It's an easy room. It's, you know, yeah, it will be nice. And then I remember getting a standing ovation after the support set in Galway. And I was like, whoa. And I kind of come off and I was shell-shocked. And I was like, oh, I'm good at this.
No, you know? Wow, yeah.
You know, but I guess it was just... Yeah, and then I was like, oh, okay. And that, I guess it kind of just switched up and you start to feel a bit different about it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, now I'm selling. Yeah, I mean, it's so funny because I was...
You're being modest, but you're selling big venues.
Yeah, I am, I guess. And it's funny because I was talking to my agent about it. And I was like, 4 Vickers Streets on one tour to sell them out would be really good before Joanne did 7.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be unbelievable.
Yeah, four, people would be really impressed by that before Joanne did 7.
Yeah, she did kind of ruin it, didn't she?
Yeah, I know. And every so often she'd go, you're putting on a 4th figure, that's amazing. Like, Joanne,
shut
please,
up, Joanne.
Please.
I don't need your pity.
Do not patronize me.
God, it's amazing though. I'm so delighted for you. And are you enjoying it?
Yeah, I'm having a ball. I mean, yeah. I really, really am. Like, it's that weird phase now, like, where, like, my tour is coming to an end. Like, I think I've 20 more dates left and that's it. But, so I'm starting to write the next one, which is, that's always exciting because it's not like, I guess, a musical act where you've got, like, this, you know, you can go out and do the next tour and have, like, the hits.
Yeah.
Whereas now you're going from... I guess going into clubs with 20 minutes of material and finding out 10 minutes of it works, and you know, which is always the bit in comedy I love, but again, I'm just like, you know, I have to be on tour next year and I have to have a great show, so it's like, just start writing, you know. So it's exciting.
It's funny that thing you said about finding your audience, particularly I think if your audience is women and gay people or queer people, I don't know where you draw the line, Croat, but I think I can see how it might be difficult to find those people because, you know, we often feel, I think, kind of excluded by a lot of comedy, or certainly feel like the butt of a joke, or historically have been the butt of a joke in a lot of comedy. But I think, you know, obviously the Joanne tour helped you there, but do you think social media can be a big part of that as well?
Oh yeah, completely. I mean, I was talking to Chris Kent about this, where, you know, we were talking about how it was such a different ballgame when we started.
Yeah.
Like, when we started around the end of, like, the 2000 and, you know, 2008, 2009, like, if you were playing a club, you were on with probably 4 other white straight guys, and everyone was trying to get on the panel. And if one person, and, you know, there were 4 slots on the panel, and if one person got on the panel, you didn't.
Yeah.
You know, so it was, like, I guess... traditionally comedy, I think, in Ireland has, and everywhere else, I mean, you know, it was led by television, it was led by there only being so many slots, it was, so that made it competitive and combative, and everyone was kind of your competition.
Yeah.
Whereas now, that's just not the case. I mean, like, for example, Chris Kent, who's selling loads of tickets at the moment and doing, like is absolutely going to be the next big thing. He is, you know, he's one of my best friends, but we're not in competition with each other. And we were talking about that on Sunday. We were like, you know, we have to be really careful that we don't fall into that old trap of, like, pulling the ladder up.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that was traditionally, I guess, what the whole generation of comedians had to do, because they had to protect their patch. Whereas we don't have to do that, because you've got a podcast, social media.
Yeah.
The people that like me come and find me. Yeah. And the same with every other comic. And it doesn't mean that they're... because they like you, they can't like somebody else.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I kind of feel the same way about, you know, my work. Like, when I was in radio, it was like there's a finite number of jobs, and there's a finite number of jobs for women, and there's a finite number of jobs for women like me, and there's only so many shows that I want to do, and it does feel competitive. As women supporting women as you want to be, it, sometimes that little edge is in there, as much as you don't like it. But the advent of podcasts and all of the other opportunities that come with kind of the internet, I suppose, you know, it means that you can carve out your corner. You don't need to be mass appeal. You don't need to get on the panel, or you don't need to be on a national radio station. You can just find your people who like you, and they can also like five other podcasts, and that's okay.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so like, it's such a relief.
Yeah.
Like, because I think that like I did an interview there a couple of weeks ago. They were like, are you worried about Shane Daniel Byrne? And I was like, no, he's amazing. Like,
I'd be worried about him, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as a
not for that reason, but
as a person, not for me.
Yeah, it's funny though, isn't it? Even that question kind of tries to corner you into like a certain, or put you in a certain pocket or something. You know, because all gay men are the same, of course.
Yeah, of course, absolutely. And we can never be on a lineup together, and like we only have the same opinions. But like, I guess this is the real, you know, this is the real opportunity in like social media and all of this stuff. And we have to just make sure that we do take it.
Yeah.
You know, because it'd be very easy just to be like, you know, like I really think the more comedians, the better. Like the more Ireland is used to seeing comedians and going to comedy, like the better for everyone. Like I just don't think nobody's served by there just being a handful of lads doing all the work.
No,
you know.
Speaking of podcasts, you have a podcast that you do with Eurovision legend and icon Niamh Kavanagh. It's called Agony Rants. Please tell the people how it came to be that you were doing a podcast with Eurovision legend and icon Niamh Kavanagh.
Yeah, that's a bit of it's a weird story. So basically, when I was a little gay teen, Niamh lived around the corner from me and won the Eurovision. And my take on it was, well, if there's a Eurovision winner in the area, we obviously have to be friends.
I mean, I respect
it. So, yeah, exactly. So I just did what, you know, all, you know, sane, well-balanced people do. And knocked on the door, was like, hi, I'd like to be friends with Niamh, please. And Niamh, unfortunately, you know, was just like, okay, I guess I have to go along with this.
How amazing, though.
I guess this is part of it. So we've been friends for like since 1994, I guess.
Sorry, maybe. I need to go back to the beginning. Like, how did that friendship grow? Like, what were you, did knock on the door and say, can Niamh come out to play? Or like, how was that working?
I mean, basically, I mean, I was a fan for a long time. Like, you know, I mean, I still have like, postcards that are like, you know, dear Garode, I'm in Nashville recording my album. Aww. Hope you're keeping well, or good luck with your junior cert. I'm sorry to hear that things with your girlfriend aren't going well. I'm sure things will all become clear in the future.
Aww, that's so sweet.
Yeah. So I guess then when I, you know, turned 20, we kind of just became mates then. So during the pandemic, she took a job and it was like all over the papers. Mm-hmm. Because like, you know, her tour was cancelled, two kids in college, husband has had a stroke. Mm. And I she was like, fine, that's, you know, but I was like, I kind of think that's shit, actually. I think no matter what a positive spin is on this, it's like, I think it's kind of shit. And I think that you know, let's show the world what you can do. She always wants to do a podcast, so I was like, let's do a podcast. So we went and did a podcast, and I thought we'll do six episodes of this. Because I had another podcast that I adored making. But and then it just took off in a way that like I very much had not expected. Like, I mean, really didn't expect. But yeah, and unfortunately, she's incredibly funny and kind-hearted, and unfortunately, people love her. And I'm really sick of people coming up to me and going, Kevin is so funny. Like, is she? Is she?
Oh, I know that feeling. Just for people, you know, what's the premise of the podcast is kind of that you can get a bit of advice.
Yeah, I guess it's people writing with their problems. And that wasn't, I actually did a call out when we were doing the pilot to say, like, if anyone wants to, you know, talk to us or had a, I can't remember what it was, maybe give us a story about something. And we got two problems in, and I was like, oh, I've clearly said something wrong. And then Neve was like, well, let's just answer them.
Yeah.
And then she came up with the name Agony Rants. So, like, really, anything that's smart or witty or funny about the podcast is all clearly down to Neve.
And yet, so, and yet you're the comedian. It's funny.
Yeah, I'm the comedian. It's been really humbling, Louise.
Yeah, I can imagine. So let's talk about the tour, because as you said, you've got dates left, and I know you've won this weekend in London, right? But then you've got loads of dates around Ireland. So what can people expect from the tour?
Glamourhammer is basically, it's more or less just about things that I'm just not particularly good at, like, you know, like being glamorous or in relationships or having pets or being an adult. So it's just like, it's definitely not a show with any sort of, you know, meaning or I'm not addressing world problems. It's just literally an hour of like funny. Let's just enjoy ourselves because we're all still alive.
Yeah.
You know, because I feel like there is a culture now of, you know, comedians that write shows about how much they're unraveling.
Yes.
And which is, you know, all great and courageous, but I'm just not that good at it. Mm-hmm. So this is just an hour and a 20 minutes of just funny. And it's running until I think April.
Yeah, I have the dates in front of me. I mean, he is all over the country, my friend. So if you want to go and see me, you absolutely can. You can get the dates on garodefarley.com/tour. He is in Longford. He's in Navan. He's in Mullingar. He's in Kilmallock. I don't know where that is. He's in Carrigan, Shannon, Dunleary, Castlebar, Carrigan. You will know. You will know when you get there.
Nina,
Portmarnock, Strabane. Like, he is getting around the place. So if you want to go and see Garode, and I highly encourage it, go to garodefarley.com/tour and you'll get all the details there. And then, you're working on new stuff. That's exciting.
Yeah, I'm trying to write the new show now, which is like, it is my favorite bit. I've forgotten how much, like, because I don't really get nervous doing the show, because I just don't. But with new material, you're just in the wings going, oh, good God.
Yeah, please.
I've never said this before. Please. Just at least some of it work.
Yeah. Well, look, good luck with that. And thanks for coming on to have a chat with me. And I hope that you have a great time traveling around Ireland doing those gigs. And you've loads of lovely people in the audience.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much, Louise. Thanks for having me.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
James O'Hagan, what a pleasure it is to have you once again in my humble abode on this freezing day.
Oh my God, absolutely frozen outside. I kind of just want to set up shop here for the day, Louise. I may not leave.
Well, I'll be honest, James, it gets pretty cold here. I'm like, how is this house so cold? And I actually find myself keep thinking, if I'm freezing in this house, like, what about the people who are in places that don't have heating,
oh my God,
or who can't afford to turn on the heat, or people who are outside? Like, I don't know how people are coping.
It is horrific. This time of year, like, I mean, you know, we go into like a tailspin over the summer when it gets too hot and we're like, oh my God, the world is ending. But you do forget actually how horrific it is when it's this cold.
Yeah.
And if you're in a space where like you don't have heating, or, you know, you aren't able to turn on the heating or can't afford to, like, it is nothing worse than sitting there freezing cold, yeah, covered in blankets that aren't really doing anything.
Yeah, I'll never forget during the big freeze, I was living in a beautiful, big, old house. And it was gorgeous and we loved it in the summer, but in the winter, I mean, you couldn't eat it.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, the windows were old windows, the rooms were big. Like, the only room that we could get even a little bit warm was the sitting room because it had a fireplace. So we'd have the fire on, and we all ended up having to go. Fortunately, we all had boyfriends at the time. We all ended up having to go and stay in our boyfriends because we were freezing the entire time. And that's not even the worst of it. So yeah, thoughts are with you if you're in a situation where you can't heat your house for whatever reason, yeah, or it's just not happening, because it is so cold.
Oh my God, it really is.
I'd love even a bit of snow. Like, if it's going to be this cold, thinking, like,
can we just transition this into a bit of an event?
Yeah.
Can we make it a bit of an event with some snow?
Yeah.
Get a couple of days off work, have that kind of like jolliness of going to the pub.
Yeah.
You know, honestly, please.
Days off work and going to the pub. Is that what you do in those?
Well, actually, this is what we used to do in pre-COVID times, because like, oh, well, now you're all set up to work from home. But like, you know, it would just, I remember like the big snow the last time, it was kind of like everyone just like making their way down to whatever the local pub was and like sitting in there
making
like
their way downtown. Sorry. Just literally can't.
But I mean, that's the vibe.
Yeah. I know. I don't remember ever doing that, but it sounds delightful.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
I would
the
just
coziness.
Be trying to probably fashion a sled out of like a tray or something and trying to find somewhere to bring the kids. Okay, we've got loads and loads and loads of celeb stuff to talk about because we are in the thick of award season, and I couldn't be happier about it.
I know, Moira Rose's favourite season, awards.
Yes, absolutely. We actually have two sets of awards to discuss, even just within this one slot, and that is the Emmys and the Critics' Choice Awards. Are they always this close together? It feels like they're really on top of each other at the moment.
Now, I do know, so with the Emmys, I think that they all always are on top of them, and I think that it's just some of the more niche awards shows, like the People's Choice and the Critics' Choice, are just garnering a bit more attention now, so we're noticing.
Yeah.
Because I think that, like, up until maybe a few years ago, kind of, we would see the Golden Globes, we would see the Oscars, you'd be aware of the Emmys, but I don't know that they were kind of breaking through here in the way that they are now, because of like sort of like influences like Evan Ross Katz and that, who are kind of like really pumping that kind of, you know, pop culture. And we're
and
loving
social
it.
Media in general.
Social
like
media
my TikTok,
general.
Because I love it, is giving me nonstop awards content. So
100%.
Yeah.
But this is the Emmys for the 2022-2023 season took place because it had to be cancelled last year due to the writer strike. So it was a bit sort of weird for me kind of watching all the stuff coming in. It was like, oh, that's a show that hasn't been on for a year. Oh, that show's finished.
Yeah, because when I was actually doing the research for this, I was like, is this about... Like, is this an old article that's been misdated that I'm reading and that I realize no?
No. But I mean, some of the big moments of the night, I have to start off now. I am an absolute slut for good in memoriam section, and the Emmys did not disappoint.
What a phrase. I love it.
But so we were saying goodbye to quite a few kind of big name people who died over the last sort of year and a half. Matthew Perry, Agnes Cloud, Len Goodman, Barbara Walters, Angela Lansbury, Kirstie Alley, and Leslie Jordan, the absolute icon.
I'd actually forgotten some of those.
I know.
Like major losses.
Absolutely. So they had Charlie Puth and a...
Puth?
I know. Charlie Puth and a group called, I think, Warren Theatre were there to give a beautiful rendition of Charlie Puth's song See You Again, and then also like a really gorgeous version of I'll Be There For You, the Friends theme as well. And you know, you had the sort of sepia theme sort of pictures of the people floating in the background. It was all very lovely, though. I got into the emotion of it.
Yeah, I feel like I might cry if I watch that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, but it was lovely. It was really, really nice. Now, I would have done without the like weird sort of cap cut montage at the end that you kind of look like it was made for like a joke sort of Instagram post, but beautifully moving segment. The whole thing, though, was kind of around commemoration, because they had taken an approach with the set design for the Emmys of kind of like recreating famous sets from days gone by, which was a really lovely way to kind of honour some of like the big, particularly the big legends who kind of had been lost over the years. So they had recreated the therapy set from the Sopranos. They'd recreated the set of I think Those Were the Days, a few other places. Mm. So that's where the awards were kind of being the nominees were being announced from. Mm. And big winner on the night was Jennifer Coolidge and The Evil Gaze.
Yeah.
I think that was number one for everyone.
I love her.
Great to see her out again, wasn't it?
Like, yeah, just like bring her to all the award shows. Even if she's not in a show, just bring her, because we want to look at her.
No, absolutely.
And hear from her.
And hear, because she is a chaotic presenter. She has a chaotic energy that I just absolutely love. Her big thank you, obviously, was to was Michael White for kind of like giving her the career resurgence. And then again, thanked all the Evil Gays for kind of, and I'm taking that to just mean all of the gays.
Yes.
All of the LGBTs and the Qs and the allies and
I
everyone.
I think that's what she means. Yeah.
And the biggest winner on the night, though, was The Bear, which is a TV show that I haven't watched. And this is, as we
you
get
haven't watched
to,
it?
No, I haven't. And this is the thing now.
I'm actually jealous.
As we get into like talking about, say, the Critics' Choice Awards and that as well, it is just so many television shows that I'm like, oh, I should watch that, and I haven't watched that. And I kind of think to myself, oh, I don't think I've got time. I haven't got time to be watching all these TV shows. And then Apple sends me my screen time and I'm like, oh, right, I need to take a seat.
As it turns out, I have the time. I'm just not using it
I'm
that
just
way.
Choosing to play Merge Mansion and be on Instagram.
Oh, you should watch The Bear, though. It is so brilliant. And it's only two seasons. And I think there's only like 6 or 8 episodes per season.
Yeah,
so it's not a huge, like, you do it in a couple of weeks, you know.
I watched the first episode of it last year and I did find myself getting into it. But it just was one of them that I needed, like, I need a day to sit down with it and get into it. And like seeing the absolute rapturous way in which this second season in particular has been received, I really want to get into it.
Yeah, even just for, there's a Christmas episode in the second series with Jamie Lee Curtis in it, which is
brilliant.
Honestly one of the best episodes of television I've ever seen. It is just spectacular. It's like a standalone film almost. And there is part of it where Jamie Lee Curtis is putting butter on bread with her bare hands. Like, I may get it tattooed on my body, like, a still from it, because it's so spectacular. She is incredible in it.
I have to say, like, because obviously 2022, 2023 gave us a bit of a Jamie Lee Curtis resurgence. And I am living for it, because she is such an underrated, like, actress, and such an underrated character in Hollywood, because she is such an intense performer.
Yeah.
Like, that Everything Everywhere All at Once performance was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, to be able to perform so beautifully when you've got like huge long sausage fingers. Yeah. I mean, but yeah, so I think that's the biggest moment, though. I think probably moving into the Critics' Choice. Well, oh no, for the Emmys, biggest losers, Better Saul Call managed to, across its 7-year run, not win a single Emmy despite being nominated for 53 of them.
Yeah, I saw that. It's like the biggest loser ever.
Yeah.
But then I saw the people, the cast of It's Always Funny. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. They were presenting an award, and their whole bit was, did you guys know that this was happening every year? Because they have never been nominated and they've been on since 2005.
That show has not been on since 2005.
Yeah, that's what
oh
they were
my
saying.
God.
And they were like, did you guys know this was happening? Like, I didn't know. And they did this whole bit about, like, you guys come here every year? Like, we've never heard. Like, we've been on since 2005. And then they asked Danny DeVito. They were like, did you know about this? And he's like, yeah, well, I got one. And they were like, oh, really? And he was like, yeah, for Taxi. And they're like, okay, how long were you on? And he was like, oh, we got this many awards, this many nominations. We were on for 5 years. And the rest of them were like, what? So I don't know. Does that somehow, I kind of beats Better Call Saul.
It does indeed. And it's sort of unfair. I mean, that show, like, had a heyday that it deserved some awards for. I'm not sure that it's still in that heyday.
Yeah.
I certainly have.
I've actually never watched it. So
there's a couple of episodes, there's a couple of seasons in there that are really, really funny, but then it kind of just goes like all the rest of them.
Yeah.
Also, Ted Lasso snubbed for its final season, having been kind of a bit of an Emmys darling for 2-3 seasons. Apparently that third season was just really not well received. So.
I didn't, we watched the first 2 series, I think, and then didn't finish it because it wasn't giving, in my opinion. So the Critics' Choice Awards also took place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the...
How fun would it be, by the way, to be going to all these?
Oh, my God.
Absolutely.
I would just love to be there, even just to be a seat filler. Just to be a seat filler, just like popping in to sit beside like America Ferrera for a moment.
I would want to be in it. Like, I'd want to be like bopping over to Taylor Swift's table and being like, hey, honey. And like, oh, Ayo, hi. Like, I'd want to be in it because that's me.
I think you bring up Ayo Edebiri there, who I think is the foremost and most important individual for us to talk about in this segment.
Could
obviously.
Not agree more.
She has been being like, she has been like mopping up the awards for The Bear over the course of last while.
And so deserved.
So deserved, and has become an unlikely Irish superstar. This took me so long to figure out.
Yeah, so I am obsessed with Ayo Edebiri and have been for some time, since season one of The Bear. Like, I just love her in it. And then the more I got to know about her, the more I realized how funny she was. I was like, okay, I stan. Like, I'm 100% in on Ayo. Because she was a TV writer before she was ever an actor. So and she's a comedian. Like, she is very, very funny.
Very funny. Very, very funny.
Yeah, so I saw this happen from the get-go. But I have gotten so many messages from people being like, can you please explain this to me? So let's explain it.
I was one of those people who was like watching TikTok. Is this a joke I'm not getting? But apparently it was at an awards show last year. I can't remember which one it was, but she was on the red carpet being interviewed it was for the Bottoms premiere. She was being interviewed on the red carpet, and she made kind of a throwaway joke about like how she had portrayed Jenny the donkey in The Banshees of Inisherin, and how she said, I lived in Ireland for about 4 months and got really into character. I was on all fours for 4 months. It was really painful but beautiful as well, which is the most random thing in the entire world. And I think Irish people love a bit of random humour, so we picked it up and absolutely ran with it. And I've been just so kind of invested in this sort of like, she's now one of her own, we're claiming her as part of us. And so she now has been, I suppose, she has across
she's picked
her,
it back up. Like, I think what happened was she made that joke, and then a couple of Irish and I feel bad now that I can't remember the specific Instagram accounts because they deserve the credit, when she won for the Golden Globes, I think they posted, or maybe it was even a previous award ceremony, someone posted, congratulations to Ireland's own Ayo Edebiri. Mm-hmm. And then she shared that and was like, you know, with a thank you hands, and then has just run with it.
Yeah, like, so as part of her, so in her acceptance speech, she said to everyone in Boston, Barbados, Nigeria, Ireland in many ways, thank you. And then on the red carpet of the Critics' Choice Award, she had shout out to Derry, shout out to Cork, shout out to Killarney, and then of course did give a shout out to Dublin. But
And now you have the whole country of Ireland that has fallen completely and madly in love with you.
Shout out to my people. Shout out to Derry. Shout out to Cork. Shout out to Killarney. Shout out to Dublin.
I think many people are absolutely killing themselves that it was Derry and Cork first, and indeed Killarney. But yeah, so she is really picking this up, and I am waiting for the moment that she arrives on these shores.
She is coming. It has been written, and so it will be. It is
coming. In the stars. But also, I have to say, she looked so beautiful. She was wearing this sort of like 3D printed, sculpted kind of black dress that was just absolutely gorgeous, so structural.
Has looked amazing though. The white suit that she wore at the Critics' Choice, which she said was kind of like almost like a throwback to Whoopi Goldberg. Like, she had these really cool 90s sunglasses on the red carpet. I'm obsessed with her.
She's absolutely stunning. Critics' Choice Awards, the other sort of major moments. A lot of kind of, I think the industry kind of reckoning with itself about the sort of, you know, past ways in which it has treated more minority people. So there's been a lot of people kind of having historic firsts. There was, I think, is it Niecy
Nash?
Yes, yeah. made a sort of as part of her kind of acceptance speech for the Dahmer for that Dahmer show. I'm mixing up the Emmys and the Critics' Choice here.
People will need to pick it up.
But sort of across the board at the Critics' Choice Award, America Ferrera spoke really powerfully about like how important it is to see yourself reflected, and as a first generation Honduran, how kind of she didn't see herself reflected, and it's so important for her to be there. Harrison Ford made a beautifully kind of moving speech.
Oh my God, so. Moving.
Yeah, where he said that he loves that the business is turning into a space that's more inclusive and is like giving
he
more
looked really emotional. He was saying
he
like
really
it's great
did.
To be here to see where our business is going, and
also,
see so many people who wouldn't have gotten opportunities getting opportunities. I was like, oh my God, Harrison Ford, are you my granddad now?
I will literally never get over the fact that he's married to Ally McBeal.
Oh, I know. And for years now. I know. They're married years.
This also gives me a segue to talk about one of my favorite tidbits of January 2024 drama. So Oppenheimer was the big winner in the night, with Christopher Nolan winning for Best Director. Now, my favorite bit of information to come out over the past month is that, so Christopher Nolan was doing a Peloton class in late last year, just randomly doing a Peloton class led by an instructor named Jen Sherman, and she was giving this class, doing her pedaling, on her doing her stuff, and then suddenly she went on this 5-minute rant about how convoluted and complicated the plot of Tenet was, how it was the most appalling film that she'd ever seen, how it was 2.5 hours of her life that she was literally never getting back. She was like, I need neurosurgeons in to explain this to me, what the hell was going on? And unbeknownst to her, Christopher Nolan was there pedaling away on his Peloton.
Oh my god, so this is iconic.
He spoke about this then in an interview. It's I was working out there away, and I was just suddenly she was reading the house down for Tenant. He went and got a bit snippy then and said that really only proper critics deserve to be criticizing feelings or whatever. Jen came out to apologize. They've all made up. They're all happy. But I just love the idea of Christopher Nolan getting onto his Peloton, and the second most shocking thing to happen on a Peloton after Mr. Big, I would say.
Wow, that is so goss. I just googled there just quickly for a bit of 22 years Calista Flockhart and Harrison Ford have been together. It's amazing.
It is absolutely amazing.
Wow, that was a really good summation. Thank you so much. And yes, we may have mixed up the Critics' Choice Awards and the Emmys, but they literally happened within 24 hours of each other.
I know, we can't be expected to keep up with everything.
Now, I am desperate to talk about this because I have been puzzling over this for months now. And this is not the Mean Girls remake in itself, but the way that they chose to market the Mean Girls remake.
Yeah.
So have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen the film yet. But I have seen the conversations about this and how it's kind of a broader kind of trend that the Mean Girls has been remade after the 2024 original Mean Girls, everyone loved it, amazing. Now 20 years later, a new one is released.
2004. Oh my god, it's okay. Maths is not our strong suit.
No, that's not what I'm not a numbers guy. But yes, not that you would know it from the trailers, this new Mean Girls is in fact a remake of the musical, which is on Broadway. Now, it is apparently fantastic. It has gotten rave reviews, the musical and indeed the movie. But people are really confused about the fact that just nowhere, apart from the subtlest little musical note in the Mean Girls logo, would you have any awareness that this is going to be a musical.
Yeah.
So you're sitting down in your chair and all of a sudden people start singing in front of you. And I know that it is a real Marmite effect. People either like musicals or they don't like musicals.
Yeah.
But this is part of a theme because we saw it happening late last year with the Wonka movie and indeed with The Color Purple, where there has been so much advertising about the fact that these big blockbuster movies are coming with not a whisper about the musical element. And apparently execs have said that they just have done a ton of market research that has told them that musicals just turn people off, that they don't want to go see them, and that the only way to do it is kind of invest a person with kind of regular non-musical trailers and then just hope that they have a good time under it, which I think is false advertising.
Yeah, I also think that it can foster really intense negativity. You know, because from what I've seen, people, you know, there are people who are getting up and leaving because I've seen Mean Girls the musical. I really liked it. The movie, I mean. I really liked it. And because I knew it was a musical. I went in with my eyes open. I think it's really fun. It's a little bit sweeter than the original, but there's still loads. Excuse me. There's still loads of laugh out loud moments. The performances are amazing.
Yeah.
I was particularly excited to see, I went to see a musical called A Strange Loop on Broadway when I was there in New York about a year and a half ago. And it's incredible, James. Oh my God, James, you would love it.
Okay.
It's not on Broadway anymore. It's closed, but it was in the Barbican in London there for a while. The tagline for it is a big black gay ass musical.
Okay,
and it explores homophobia and gay identity and race and body stuff.
I need to see it.
But the guy who I saw play the lead role, who was on the stage for the entire musical, is Damien in
amazing
Mean Girls, yes, the musical. So like, they're really good people. Renee Rapp is obviously unbelievable. The performances are great. But if you go in thinking that you're going to get 2004 Mean Girls, and then it opens with a literal song, you're going to be like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
And I you're immediately going to, you're starting from a point of negativity because you feel like you've been sold a lie.
And it does a real disservice to the people who've put time, effort, and energy into actually creating the film. Because if you give people, but I think what they've said is that musicals are currently out, what's happening. So if you go back to, say, the early 2010s, where you had, say, like Les Mis, and you had The Greatest Showman, like, they were music forward. Yeah. They were like, this is what we are. And it was really in at the time. But then there was a string of musical flops where, say, like, I think everyone's talking about Jamie and In the Heights. These things that people had anticipated were going to do really well.
Dear Evan Hansen,
that they expect. They led with the kind of the music on them, and they've done really well. So they've gone to this more kind of, let's sneak people into the theatre and remind them that they like musicals through the fact that they've now spent, like, Mortgage Your House to get cinema tickets to go see it. I personally think it's the wrong way to go about it. It's really going to kind of like put a lot of people off, and you'll end up with more discourse about kind of like, no, I didn't know it was a musical, then like, oh my God, this was a really good and excellent
fun film, which it is.
I do wonder if that this is going to take a turn when Wicked is released, because there is no hiding the fact that Wicked is a musical.
That's a good point. And maybe that will bring people back on board, as long as it's good. And it better be.
I know. They really, at this stage, they have to do something spectacular.
It has got to be good.
But I'm excited to see Mean Girls a musical, but I know that I'm walking in to see something that isn't a faithful recreation of the 2004 classic, which I hold dearly and love and watch many times a year, that I'm going to see something different.
Yeah.
But I think that if I had been going in expecting to see something that was a complete recreation, or was like kind of a new take on that was going to just be straight up kind of retelling, I certainly would be thrown by the fact that suddenly everyone was singing and dancing. I'm like, I didn't buy a ticket to High School Musical.
That's not what I thought I was coming for. I totally agree. I think, you know, it's a questionable approach for sure. Okay, I really wanted to talk about Kate Moss's 50th birthday party.
Oh my God. This I mean, to be honest, can we say that we're not necessarily talking about Kate Moss's birthday party so much as we are talking about the Daily Mail reporting on it, which is written in with all the spies of an uninvited acquaintance.
It is written with all this body, but uninvited acquaintance who stood outside with their ear pressed to the door.
Stopped in their tracks. But the Daily Mail is ultimate Daily Mailing with this.
Yeah.
So Miss Moss, as she is referred to throughout, I think that like feminism has finally taken over the Daily Mail, where they now use just MS for all women rather than distinctions between MRS and MISS.
Yeah, I'm kind of into.
But so Kate Moss turned 50 over the weekend, which honestly, she is like perpetually like 22 in my head. So
yeah, she's gorgeous. I actually met her last year, and she does look older, but she still looks stunning.
Oh yeah, no, she is stunning. And she does like, she is kind of like the classic like party girl, and seems like she hasn't lost.
Although she doesn't drink anymore.
And she's embraced spirituality.
She apparently has. I know. I've got some very, very, very expensive tea upstairs, which would is evidence of that embracing of spirituality.
But so she had a...
I did not pay for the tea, by the way.
She had a sort of a fashionably star-studded birthday party at a restaurant in Paris with gorgeous views of the Eiffel Tower. Kate Moss was there with Stella McCartney, Venus Williams, Edward Enfield, and Charlotte Tilbury, among sort of other friends. These details throughout the article, they're just like phrasing that I just absolutely... So this Parisian restaurant is known for its mousseline brioche with golden caviar, blue lobster salad, and cod confit with sauce for gay. And I'm like, no, you're like known for your potato. I don't know, like just like such a convoluted, like I'm like, oh yeah, absolutely. Oh, I know that place. It's about, it's got the place with the mousseline brioche, the golden caviar, blue lobster salad, cod confit with sauce for gay.
Of course.
But so Miss Moss arrived at 9:10, but the party did not get going until 10:30 on the dot, when Neil Young started playing and the party really got going with his 1992 Joker Harvest Moon.
I don't know about you. Yeah, I don't know about you, but if there's a song that's going to get me going, it's Neil Young's Harvest Moon.
Absolutely. And
it was a great song.
Great song.
Party starter? I'm not so sure.
Followed by probably people indicating their age, Baby Love, Sympathy for the Devil, and Rebel Rebel. People danced Kate Moss danced non-stop from 10:30 to 2 a.m.
Wonderful.
go for you. But passerbys have been stopped dead in their tracks, to see what was going on in there. And one person overheard Kate Moss shouting to an unidentified acquaintance, "You're not going to get kicked out. Just go ask for a lighter."
Oh, I love it.
And asked if she was having a fun night on exiting the event, she remained tight-lipped, saying true to her longtime mantra, never complain, never explain. Fully ripped from the Queen. We love it.
I love it so much. But I also have to say, one of my favourite bits of this art, are we calling it an article?
I think we'll just call it art. This art.
The bit about Charlotte Tilbury's car getting robbed. I don't know if you saw this, but basically Charlotte Tilbury leaves the party and someone else has gotten into her paid for car. Mm-hmm. And she's apparently standing on the pavement, giving out yards down the phone, asking for the number of the driver, saying, "I've paid for his car and he's fucking robbed it."
Now, interestingly,
that I would be fuming.
I would be absolutely fuming. I mean, I'm like disgusted if someone tries to jump in a taxi ahead of me, never mind if I'd actually paid for it. But I was like reading through this article yesterday afternoon and then went back to read it in the evening and some of the details have been taken out.
Including Miss
Tilbury shouting about someone's stolen car and standing in the thing shouting, "I'm fucking cold." Also the piece about a male party goer who revealed that Moni Sadie Frost had lost her passport. That has also been deleted.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And so I have the screenshots to prove it if you...
Yeah, because I was literally just looking in the article there for the Charlotte Tilbury bit, and I was like, why can't I find it?
No, because when I read through it in the afternoon, I was like absolutely killing myself, and it was those details about like Charlotte Tilbury and the stolen car, and like the male party goer with Moni Sadie Frost. And then I went back to read it, and I was like, this is much more watered down, and also like now the headline makes no sense because who lost her passport?
Yeah. Yeah, who made a phone call? I wonder.
This is what I want to know.
That is so funny. I love it so much. And then finally, just before I let you go. Kate Blanchett is in Dublin. I just wanted to advise all Kate Blanchett lovers to have your eyes peeled. She may not still be here. She may still be here, but she certainly was here.
Yeah, she was spotted down in Stony Batter looking like a glam Mrs. Brown.
Really?
I think the red hair, the house coat, all the rest of it. Filming scenes for Jim Jarmusch's father, mother, sister, brother on Oxman Town Road. So that is very exciting. We love to have the stars in, obviously. She looks stunning and hopefully she is still around. Apparently this film will continue filming here for a while and also be shooting in, I think, somewhere in France and also in New Jersey.
Okay, so keep your eyes peeled. Be on Blanchett Watch, but don't make a fool of us. That is,
no,
please.
Absolutely.
We need to maintain our reputation for being a good place
absolutely.
To be
we need
famous.
To be, yeah, we need to be continue to be seen as cool.
Exactly.
In the eyes of celebrities.
James O'Hagan, thank you so much. Tell the people about Queeriosity.
Thank you so much. Yes, so Queeriosity goes out every Saturday on Dublin City FM at 12, or you can catch it on a podcast if you're not the sort of person who's out of bed by that time on a Saturday, and I know many people aren't, but it's a wonderful show. Myself and Padraig Wilson-McCarty will catch you up on all of the queer news of the week. We have some great interviews with some wonderful people doing amazing things in the Irish scene, cultural stuff, and all sorts of other crack and carry on. So do come over and give us a listen, or come and follow me on James_O'Hagan. Is that my gang? Who knows? Find me and follow me if you want.
I second that emotion. You could do so much worse than following James O'Hagan. Have a great one. Just about time for me to finish up and head off. But before I do have a few recommendations for you. The first two you've probably heard about. First of all, if you have not engaged with the Great Pottery Throwdown, what are you doing with your life? It is the perfect, wholesome, pure, comforting, lovely January viewing. Only two episodes have aired so far and you can catch up with them on it's not All Four anymore, is it? Channel4.com, whatever, the Channel 4 streaming service. You could catch up on them and get in. There's many weeks of comforting viewing ahead of us. Get on board. It's so lovely. Then I want to recommend Big Boys, which I know I've mentioned before, but the new series has come out and it is just as good, if not better, than the first series. It is a perfect television show. Like, I just don't know that there are many that are better. It is full of heart, but it is laugh out loud funny. It is only short, half an hour. There's only six episodes in each series, so it's not like a huge undertaking. I actually wish there was more. The cast are brilliant. The writing is brilliant. It takes place mostly in 2014, which is like a brilliant time to go back to because you still remember it, but it's got a little bit of nostalgia. I love it so, so much. And I am begging you to give yourself the treat of Big Boys at this season. Please, please do it for yourself. It's all on channel4.com. And I love it with my whole heart. I would talk about it forever. I just beg you to give it a go. Other than that, as I mentioned, Poor Things is absolutely fantastic. Next week, I'll be able to tell you about All of Us Strangers because I am going to a screening of that this weekend. And I'm so excited to go and cry for about 2.5 hours. And that is where we stand currently. I hope, my friends, that you have a good week. But if you can't have a good week, that's okay. It's not so easy at the moment. Just keep going. We will be back again next week. In the meantime, thank you so much to all of my contributors. Thank you so much to Acast for having me on the network. And I will talk to you then.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Flimsy stands slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable, North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's armodillo.com and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo, built to last, designed to impress.